Good evening, and welcome to lesson two of Journey of the Soul. As we just discussed, we had a quite eventful week in Texas last week, and although we tried our best to do the class in subsequent nights, but it became clear that it was impossible because power was lost. When it was on for one, it was off for the next, etc., etc. But we are delighted to be here at last, and we'll continue tonight with lesson two, and we'll just be delayed and on a new schedule. It will cover the span of 7 Mondays instead of just 6. So thank you all for being here. Everyone looks warm and looks light and lit up. So let's thank God for that. And we are ready for lesson two of Journey of the Soul, which is called Taking Leave, Our Evolving Relationship with the Departed. So this woman comes to the rabbi and says, "Rabbi, could I have a few minutes? Could you do me a favor and take a look at my will, if you can just read through it to make sure it's kosher, if you will?" He says, "Sure, I'll do that." So he's reading and moving along, and then he comes towards the end and like, "Whoa, I do not want to be I don't want to be buried in a Jewish cemetery." And he's like, "What? I mean, everything until here was good, but did you think this would just pass me by? Why don't you want to be buried in a Jewish cemetery?" She said, "Actually, I would like to be buried at Neiman Marcus." So, what does that mean? So she says, "Well, like this, I know that my daughters will visit me at least once a week." So last week we discussed what the definition of life is, and we established at length, and I'm not going to repeat much, just a nugget. Last week we established, actually 2 weeks ago, we established that life refers to the soul. When we say life, when we talk about a person being alive, that all refers to the soul. And we talked about the fact that the soul has its origin before the body, it exists before it comes into the body, and it also exists after its time in the body here in this world. And the soul lives on for eternity. And that we established already last 2 weeks ago in lesson one. The question today is, okay, so we know that the soul lives on for eternity. The question, though, is what is the nature of my relationship or our relationship with our loved ones after they leave this world? So we know that the soul lives on forever. Okay, that's wonderful. But what happens to the soul? Does it just move along to a new spiritual plane and that's where it remains and it just goes off and lives happily ever after? Or does the soul maintain any sense of a relationship with us, with those that were left behind, the loved ones who are mourning the soul that left the world? Do we maintain a relationship with the soul? Does the soul maintain and have a continued relationship with those that are left behind here? That's going to be what we're going to be exploring in tonight's class in lesson two. The nature, if there's a relationship, and the nature of the relationship between the soul and its loved ones, his or her loved ones, that are left behind. So the lesson tonight is going to be covering four different points in the discussion. Namely, we're going to be discussing the moment of passing, the moment of passing. We're going to discuss what comes right after that, the soul's departure from the body. We're going to discuss traditions regarding the body of the deceased. And we're also going to conclude with discussing grave visitation. So we're going to just want to welcome those who are just joining us, Ron, Nadine, Howard, Thank you for joining, Elena. Thank you for joining. We just got started and we are jumping right in. If I had to ask you, in simple terms, what is happening at the moment that someone is passing away? If you would unmute just for 5 seconds and just tell us what's happening when the person passes away. Nothing too deep or profound, just on a very simple level.
The bodily functions stop.
Okay, the body ceases to function. Anyone else?
It almost seems to me that the body somewhat deflates or something. It's like when the soul passes, the body just compresses a little bit. I mean, I've seen it several times.
Okay, the soul is passing. The soul is parting. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Joanne, one last.
The body becomes inanimate.
Okay.
Inanimate.
Right. Got you. Thank you. Thank you all. So what's happening at the moment of passing is quite simply the soul is departing from the body. The soul is detaching. It's beginning the process of untethering itself from the body. It is beginning a new journey. It's beginning a new phase. And at that very moment, the soul is departing from the body. That is the moment of passing. Now, in order to appreciate what exactly is going on, we're going to introduce a very well-known letter. And this letter was written by Rabbi Schneur Zalman of the Adi, who was the founder of the Chabad movement, the Chabad school of thought. And the contents of this letter is really well known. And I'm just going to give a little bit of an introduction before we actually read a segment of that letter. And the introduction goes like this. So we started discussing the soul. We discussed it in lesson one. We're talking about the soul right now. But Kabbalah has a lot more to say about the soul, which we're not going to get into a whole lot of it tonight or during this course, because this course is focusing on a specific topic within the soul. Nonetheless, I do want to share what Kabbalah teaches about what a soul is comprised of. And that is that even though we refer to our soul as a soul actually has five different components or five dimensions, if you will. Namely, they each have Hebrew names, although the names don't really give much away. In Hebrew, they're called Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, Yechida. Those names don't really mean anything as far as our conversation goes tonight. It's as if I'm calling it soul, 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 soul. Five different names, but not relevant. What we're going to discuss is two or three of the five. Namely, and we're starting from the bottom in this conversation. The lowest level of the soul is called Nefesh. One up is called Ruach, and then Neshama. These are three of the lower three of the five dimensions of the soul or levels of the soul. What are they? So I'm going to explain a little bit about two or three of them. So we're going to start with the lowest one. The lowest level of the soul, which is called Nefesh, is the level of the soul that actually animates the body. The biological function of the body is animated by the lowest level of the soul. In other words, not the entire soul actually comes into the body. Only a smaller measure of it does. A ray of the soul actually does. Most of the soul actually stays above. But we're not going to get into that right now. The lowest level of the five levels is the one that actually animates the biological function of the body. The fact that my hand is moving right now, this is a result of the lowest of the five levels of the soul that is allowing this my body to function. That's the level of Nefesh. But yes, I'm able to move my hand, but there's more to me. I also have emotions. We also have a personality. We have our character. We have our feelings. That whole reality of the person, our emotions, are animated by the next level of the soul, called ruach in Hebrew. So the lowest was nefesh, which animates the body, the biological function of the body. The next level up is called ruach, that animates the emotional reality of the human being. And then we don't only have movement, we don't only have emotions, we also have intellect. The third level, which is called neshama, even though neshama is also used for the soul as a whole, so let's not worry about the names right now. The third is what animates the intellectual reality of the person. So we have our three levels, and we're going to focus on the lower two right now, actually. The one that the lowest level, nefesh, that animates the body, and one higher, which is ruach, that animates the emotional reality of one's life. Now, I gave this introduction so that we'll better appreciate the letter that we're going to read shortly. Now, why are these levels relevant? So specifically, nefesh and ruach. When a person passes away, so the level of ruach and higher, whatever was associated with the body, departs from the body. The lowest level of the soul, nefesh, actually remains with the body, even after the soul departs from the body. Now, I'm not suggesting that nefesh remains in the body or it doesn't animate the body, but it stays close to the body. And more on that later. Let's go ahead and read this segment of a letter from the Alter Rebbe, Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi. And this will help us understand, gain a profound appreciation for of how to define and what the essence of the relationship is between the departed soul and its loved ones that remain behind. What is the essence of that relationship? How does one relate to the other? And we'll read it, and then we'll explain further, and hopefully we'll gain a lot of insight in the process. So if you don't mind opening to your book, page 43, text 1A, that is. And I'm going to ask Lynn if you'd like to be our first reader tonight. I think I'm giving you the longest one, but I picked the right person for it. If you could please read for us text 1A, take it away.
As it is known, the life of tzaddik, righteous person, is not physical but spiritual. It consists of faith, reverence, and love for God. During the tzaddik's lifetime on earth, these three attributes that belong to the soul dimension of ruach are constrained within their container and garb, namely the nefesh that is bound to the corporeal body. This imposes the restraints of physical space upon these attributes. As a result, all the tzaddik's disciples receive but a glow of these ruach attributes, a mere ray that is emitted beyond the container by means of the tzaddik's holy words and thoughts. The inability to receive directly from ruach is a revelatory handicap. And therefore, our sages stated that it takes 40 years for students to fully plumb the depths of their master's teaching. By contrast, after the tzaddik's passing, the nefesh separates from the ruach and remains in the grave, while the ruach and its three attributes rise to the Gan Eden. Consequently, whoever is close to the tzaddik can receive directly from his ruach in Gan Eden, because the ruach is no longer restrained in a container or confined to a physical space. There is now a straightforward path for the tzaddik's disciples to connect with the essence of the master's ruach, the faith, awe, and love with which the tzaddik served God, and not merely these attributes' outer glow that escaped beyond their container. The disciples connect and receive commensurate to the degree of their loving connection and closeness to the tzaddik during his lifetime and after his death. For the transmission of all things spiritual is always by means of great love.
Thank you. So this is a very well-known and profound letter, which contains a very big idea and really illuminates and offers insight into this concept of how we relate to souls after they pass on. And it's really an illuminating piece from the Tanya that guides many, many, many people within this reality. And I'm going to try to explain it a little bit based on what we said before and what we just read in the letter. So what is the essence of a life of a righteous person? A righteous person, their life is not defined by their material possessions or the just physical experiences. It's not defined by their next meal or defined by their next vacation. What defines a righteous person's life is their faith in God, their love of God, and their awe of God. That's who they are. Now, all these things, which level of the soul do all these things relate to? They actually relate, the two levels that we explained before, they relate to ruach. Ruach is what animates the emotions of the person, as opposed to nefesh that animates the biological bodily functions of a person. In other words, a righteous person's life is defined by the ruach level of his soul, not just by the nefesh ruach of his soul. Now, what happens when a person is alive in this world, when soul is enclosed in the body? So there's an advantage and there's a disadvantage. The advantage of a person being alive, soul within a body, is of course that we can see them and we can relate to them and we can talk to them. They're here, they're present. There's also a disadvantage of a soul being enclosed in a body. And that is that the soul isn't able to express itself fully. There are certain souls that are every soul really is limited by the body that it's enclosed within. So the soul on its own is capable of a lot more, has much greater potential, is much more intense, but it has to be confined in order to remain and live life in the body. It's not able to express itself in its full intensity and also remain in a body. So the advantage of someone being alive in this world is that they're here. The disadvantage is that they're in a body, and the body limits the extent of how much their soul could be expressed. Say, for example, if I have a high definition video that I'm trying to play, and excuse the mundane analogy, I hope it doesn't ruin the point we're trying to bring out, but I just need to say something. So say that you have a high definition video and you're trying to play it on an old fashioned screen. You know, the ones that are not flat screens, but the ones that have like a full depth that you have to like bang to get it to go. So a high definition video is not going to be able to play on that screen because the screen is not capable of integrating or taking in or a HD video to play through it. Similarly, the soul, which is high definition times infinity, the soul isn't able to function fully and express itself fully within the body because the body, just by definition, the body is physical and the body limits the extent of how much one's soul could express itself while it's in the body. Am I making sense so far?
Good.
Yeah? Okay. You can just give me a thumbs up and we'll take questions soon. So the point we're making here is this. When a person passes away, when the soul leaves the body, what happens then? So we said before that the lowest level, nefesh, remains with the body. Ruach departs. What does it mean that ruach departs? That means what this person really stood for now leaves the body and is able to express itself with much greater intensity than it was able to. Than it was able to while it was alive. When the soul was in the body, it was being limited and confined by the body, and you weren't able to access the full essence of that person's soul. Now that the soul left the body, yes, of course, there's a disadvantage, and that's why we mourn that we don't have the person and their physical presence here anymore. But what's happening at that moment, something profound is happening. A new potential is being born at the moment of the soul's passing. And that is that at that moment, the ruach of their soul is now not confined by the body anymore. And therefore, his or her loved ones, those left behind, we are able to connect to that person's soul with a much greater measure and a greater intensity than we were able to while they were alive in this world. Because again, to sum it up in two lines, when they're alive here in a body, the soul is confined by the body. It expresses itself only to a limited extent, not in its full essence, not in its full glory. The moment the soul, the ruach of the soul, departs the body, that level of the soul, which is the person's emotional makeup and their faith in God and their character and their personality, all that leaves the soul, all that leaves the body. At that moment, it now becomes possible. A new potential is born at that moment that we can now relate to our loved one who we lost with in a much greater and a more intense level than was possible beforehand while the soul was still in a body. So there's a very powerful spiritual energy being unleashed at the very moment of passing. The soul is parting and detaching from the body. And what we just explained is that the nefesh, the lowest level, remains close to the body, and more on that soon. The ruach, which is what we really look and yearn to connect to in a person. When we want to connect to a person, to our loved ones, we're not trying to connect to their body. Of course, we want to relate to their soul through their body. But we're trying to connect to their soul even when they're here, even when they're alive in this world. What we're loving is who they are, is their personality, their emotions, their soul, not just the body, as we discussed last week, last class. So that becomes the potential for that intensifies to a much greater degree at the moment that the soul actually parts from the body. And this applies to everyone, by the way, not just someone who's officially a tzaddik or a righteous person. It applies to anyone and everyone that we gain, and that we gain the potential, and we have a greater access to the person's soul after the soul leaves the body. And how is that done? How do we do that? In the closing lines of the segment of the letter that we just read, thank you, Lynn, we read that that's done through love. By us continuing to love our loved one who we lost. By love, through love, by continuing to express our love for our loved one who passed away, that is the vehicle to gain access to their soul in a greater measure than we ever did before. And by the way, it's very possible, and we can all relate to this, I think, after someone passes away, we begin to appreciate the good qualities of a person much more than while they were here. Now, obviously, there's some practical reasons for that too, because, you know, we're less exposed to their less than perfect side, let's say. But there has to be a deeper reason for that. And that is because their soul has been unleashed fully, with its full intensity. So even the things that we may not have appreciated while they were alive in a body, now we're able to, because it is unleashed and more accessible to us. And it's not being limited or confined by the body and any less than perfect side that the body brought to that soul's reality. And that's why we find ourselves focusing on their good qualities, and in general, focusing on them much more. Every step of the way, when they were alive, we didn't think about them this much. But now we are. And that's because their soul is more present and more accessible to us than it ever was beforehand. Now, like in any relationship, we always have to relate to the other person. Let's just say a spouse. When we want to express love, we have to do it on their terms. We can't express love on our terms, because then I'm loving myself. I'm not loving the other person. So we always have to think about the other person when we want to express love. Regardless of who it is, it always has to be on the other's terms. Similarly, after our loved one passes on, or anyone passes on and leaves this world, and we want to connect with them and relate to them today, we have to think about what defines them today. we have to think about what, in what terms do I need to connect with them in their current reality? It has to be on their terms. In other words, it's very possible that our loved one may have liked a certain type of ice cream or a certain type of music. And maybe on their birthday or on any special day or any random day, you want to connect with them by buying that same ice cream that they would have loved. There's nothing wrong with that. Don't get me wrong. That's okay. But what we have to realize is that after the soul leaves this world and leaves the body, it relates a lot less, if at all, to that, to those aspects of the person that existed while the soul was in a body. If we want to connect with the soul on its terms, the way it is presently in its current reality, we have to think about what spiritual aspects did this person really appreciate. And now the soul is appreciating them to a much greater degree where it is now. Let's just say, for example, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but let's say someone, while they were here, maybe they went to synagogue once a month, or let's even say they went once a year or twice a year to synagogue. So you wouldn't, let's say, describe them as the most spiritual person. But yet right now, where they are now, they're going to synagogue every day, maybe even twice a day. So we have to think about relating to the person, not necessarily the way or by what their bodily or physical priorities were when they were here, but we have to relate to them even on even if it was a small amount in terms of their time or priority when they were alive. Those are the terms that we have to think about in relating to that soul currently in their present reality. So for starters, just to close off this segment, we asked a question in the beginning. Do we have a connection to the soul after it leaves this world? The answer is absolutely yes. Not only do we have a connection to the soul, we have the potential for an even greater connection to the soul, because the body and the limitations that the body presents were removed. And now we're able to connect with our loved one's soul to an even greater degree than we ever did before. So the answer is a resounding yes. And we'll continue on this theme as we proceed through this through the lesson. I'm going to share my screen just for a 2.5 minute idea and meditation like we did last time. Let's see if I can find it. Give me just 1 second here.
Meditation reflection for lesson 2 of Journey of the Soul. We're going to try to visualize and relate to the idea of the continuing connection between those who are still inhabiting this world and their loved ones who have moved on. How can we visualize this connection? So I want to share with you a metaphor that was given by the Lubavitcher Rebbe to a grieving family when they lost their dear mother. The Rebbe told the family, "You should know that your loved one, when they pass away, hasn't gone to some faraway place. Really, what is the situation? It's as if the whole family is together on the first floor of the house, and this loved one is in the same house with you on the second floor. So we're going to try to visualize. Again, if it helps you to close your eyes, you can close your eyes. With your eyes open, with your eyes open. But start to visualize in your mind's eye a loved one who's passed on. try to imagine what it was like when you would gather and that person was physically with you. Try to remember the sights, the sounds, the whole setting. And now, imagine that exact same gathering, same setting. And that loved one who's passed on is still there with one difference. They're on the second floor. Take a moment to imagine the feeling. It's hard to describe it, but if we envision it, we may be able to feel it. What does it feel like? The knowledge that this loved one may not be able to see them, but they're right there, very, very close by, in the same house where the family is together, everyone is there, and the only difference is they're upstairs, they're on the second floor.
Okay, so that was Rabbi Shai Taub once again with a meditation which he presents for each one of the lessons in this course. Any very quick questions before we continue? Yes, Lou, please unmute. We're going to dedicate 2 minutes to questions and answers, so we have a lot to cover. Yes.
So after the soul has passed, and Ruach is outside of the body, is there a conscious or recognizable connection, or is it an unconscious, unrecognizable connection that's there?
Conscious and recognizable to who?
To the loved ones who still remain.
So if we can have
Or students, or whoever, you know, but not necessarily family.
So if we have a conscious relationship with the soul, is that the question? Not about the soul to us, but us to the soul.
Or when we receive, well, it's a two-way connection, I guess. It's never
so the answer is yes to both. If we continue to express our love, and like we noted before, love is the vehicle, how we can access the soul, especially after its passing, then we have a conscious connection, just like we just heard from Rabbi Taub. If our loved one was upstairs, and you know what? The last 12 months, I think, can help us appreciate this very much. There were gatherings of families in the last 12 months, and an elderly loved one, maybe a grandparent, or similar, or parent for an older family, had to remain upstairs or had to remain behind the wall. So would anyone think that they're not present at this birthday party, even though they're behind the wall? Is there not a conscious relationship between everyone else in the family and the family member who had to be in a different room or on a different floor? There absolutely is. And it just depends on how much effort we put in to express our love, and the more we do, the more we will access the soul. Any other questions? No? Okay, we will proceed. So here's, to begin the next section of the class, I'm gonna ask this question. Is death painful for the soul? Is death painful for the soul? And this is something that people think about and people ask. It's not an uncommon question that people wonder and discuss and inquire about. And based on what we discussed last week, and we kind of touched upon two sides to this conversation already, in last class we talked about the fact that the soul doesn't want to come into this world, doesn't want to come into a body. We also discussed the fact that once it's here, it doesn't want to leave. And they're both true. And we'll discuss more of that soon. But the question now is, based on everything that we just said about the moment of passing, and we said how the ruach of the soul is unleashed from the body. Of course, Ruach and higher, but Ruach already is unleashed from the body. And it becomes much more accessible to us at that stage because it doesn't have the limitations of the body anymore. So in a certain way, there's something that there's of course, we never wish this, but there's a positive that's emerging at the moment of passing. So you may think that the soul is liking this. In other words, the soul is now unleashed from the body and is able to, and is free to soar to heaven and to heavenly realms. And you would think that it actually enjoys it. We're going to learn something very profound. And this is sourced in the Zohar, which is the seminal work of Kabbalah attributed to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who lived in the second century. So this, like everything else that we're quoting in these lessons, go back to Talmud, to Midrash, to Kabbalah, and are all sourced in ancient Jewish wisdom. And that's what we're teaching and sharing in these classes. So in text number 2, it's a very short text. And Elena, would you like to read that one line for us, please, on page 47, text number 2?
Nothing is as hard for the soul as its separation from the body.
Wow, states the Zohar, nothing is as hard for the soul as its separation from the body. Now, why would it be so difficult and painful for the soul to detach from the body? So there's a few points that we'll touch on to explain this. Number one, transitions are difficult. And everyone knows this. Transitions are always difficult. Even having power taken away from you for 3 days is difficult to move on from it. Yes, some people just bounced right back. Other people, the first time it ever happened to them in their life, and it's difficult. Anyone that ever transitioned from something to something else, that had to move on from something or move out of something, knows that transitions are difficult. Just think about sending a child, a son or a daughter, off to college. Yes, there is a day when you go or they travel or you go personally and drop them off, and they moved out on that day. But that doesn't mean that they've also moved on. They may have moved out. They didn't move on. It's the beginning of a transition for them to become comfortable in this new reality of college. For you to become comfortable as an empty nester is a transition. It takes time. It's a process. And this is the case with everything across the board. Most certainly for the soul, which is now transitioning away from a reality that it knew for decades and decades, for 70, 80, 90, hopefully 120 years, the soul is now transitioning from that reality. And that is painful. Just like a parent and child, I have a son in boarding school in Michigan this year. He's only 13. Yes, you drop him off. But at the same time, he doesn't move on. We're deeply attached. I get about 3 or 5 phone calls a day from him. I can't take every single one of them, but certainly 1 or 2 a day, and et cetera, et cetera. I don't need to expound on something this obvious. Transitions are difficult. So for the soul to move on from what it was comfortable with is very difficult. It's painful. That's number one. Number two, as we noted last week, the soul can only fulfill its mission while it's here in this world. Once it leaves the body, it loses that opportunity. That is painful. Number three, and this is perhaps most important, over time, the soul develops an attachment to the body. It's not just that any transition is difficult. The soul and the body connect in a very unique way because the body is what allowed the soul to fulfill its mission in this earth. The soul wants to fulfill its mission. It cannot do it without the body. And being that it went about its life's mission, intertwined and enclosed and deeply embedded within the body for decades and decades, therefore, it develops an appreciation for the body and it identifies with the body. Even though, like we said and expounded upon, that it comes from a different origin and it's spiritual as opposed to physical, but it begins to identify with the body. When that comes to an end, it's painful for the soul to detach and begin the process of divestment from the soul. And those points are spelled out in figure 2.2, transitions, mitzvahs only in this world, as well as detaching from the very body with which the soul went about its life's mission. We're going to read now a series of short texts, which are going to expound and give us more details and more information about the process that begins. So we had the moment of passing, as we said before, when the soul begins its journey and detaches. At the same time, there is a process that just launched. And we're going to take a look at different phases of this process. I'm going to ask Jeffrey, can you please read for us, one after the other in succession, text number 3, then immediately 4A, 4B, and 4C.
For 3 days, the soul hovers above the body, thinking that it can return to it. After 3 days, when it sees that the body's face has changed, it leaves the body and departs. For 7 days, the soul goes from the house where it lived to the grave, and from the grave back to the house, and it mourns its body. After 7 days, the body is subjected to its fate, and the soul ascends to its place. For 30 days, the soul and the body are judged as one, and thus the soul is located down here on earth. After that, the soul ascends while the body erodes in the earth. For 12 months, the body still exists, and the soul ascends and descends. After 12 months, the body becomes null, and the soul rises and no longer returns.
Thank you, Jeffrey. So let me ask you, we just read four texts, and they seem to be saying four different things. That it takes 3 days for the soul to move on, that it takes 7 days for the soul to move on, 30 days, and then 12 months. So which one is it? And we already know the answer. They're all right, because this is a process for the soul to transition and divest itself from the body and to move on to its new reality, its new spiritual reality. It is a process and it's a transition, and it happens in phases. There is a change that happens after 3 days, another after 7 days, another after 30 days, and again, finally, after 12 months. The departure is a process. Now, here is something mind-blowing, if you will. We just said that the soul is experiencing a very painful process by detaching from the body. And as we just spelled out from the sources in the Zohar and the Talmud, that the soul doesn't move on from the body right away. In fact, it tries to come back to the body for 3 days. And then it tries to come back to its home where it lived for 7 days. Hence Shiva, by the way. But more on that in next week's class. And then 30 days. And then 12 months. So what's happening here is that the soul is detaching slowly but surely. And its pain of detaching from the body is being diminished slowly but surely. So we said it's a painful experience, but that pain is weakening with time after 3 days, 7 days, 30 days, and eventually 12 months. Now here is something very profound, which you may be surprised to learn, that Jewish law guides mourners of how to mourn. Now, of course, mourning is deeply personal, and no two people go about it the same way. At the same time, Judaism offers and suggests a framework of how to go about it. And the wow factor here is that the very steps that Jewish law gives the mourners for how to mourn and how to slowly re-enter life as they knew it before the loss, if you will, reflects the same phases that the soul was experiencing during that time. Let's read these texts. Let's read text number 5 and text number 6. Can I ask Linda, please? 5 and 6.
No. Okay. Mourners observe 3 days of weeping, 7 days of eulogies, and for 30 days, restrictions on haircuts and wearing freshly ironed clothing, mirroring, joining a celebration of friends, and traveling on business. If you encounter an acquaintance within 30 days of that person having lost a next of kin, offer words of consolation and avoid the customary pleasantries. If 30 days have elapsed since a relative's passing, greet your acquaintance in the usual manner and offer indirect words of consolation. Avoid mentioning the deceased by name and extend a generic consolation such as, may you be comforted. If your acquaintance is mourning the loss of a parent, you should offer direct messages of comfort for the first 12 months, and only after that, scale it back to indirect consolation.
Thank you, Linda. The Talmud and Kabbalah that we just read reveal to us that the phases in the mourning process reflect the very stages of the departure of the soul from the body. In other words, our degree of mourning reflects and mirrors what the soul is experiencing at the same time and at each one of these phases. What does this tell us? Of course, when one is mourning, we are mourning our loss, and we are grieving from the fact that we lost a loved one. But there's something more going on here. We're not only mourning for the soul that we lost, we're also mourning with the soul that we just lost. The soul is also in mourning because the soul is detaching from the body, which is very painful. And after 3 days and 7 days and then 30 days, it becomes less and less as it becomes more and more accustomed to its new spiritual reality. So as the soul is experiencing less pain from its detachment from the body, we also weaken our measure of mourning. In other words, we are mourning and expressing our empathy for the soul, for the one who we just lost. The soul is also experiencing a loss from the body. And when we mourn, we are not just mourning our loss, we're also mourning with the soul for its loss and the fact that it left the body. And we follow these exact phases. Jewish law tells us that the first 3 days of Shiva are the most intense, where crying is more prevalent. Then for 7 days, a little bit less, and eulogizing a lot. And then certain mourning practices are removed after 7 days, but others stick around for 30 days, while then additional mourning practices are removed after 30 days and some remain for a full 12 months. So for example, and I shared with you last time that I'm about 10 months, a little more than 10 months into mourning my father. 2 weeks ago, I went to a nephew's bar mitzvah in Dallas. But while I did participate, because it's a family member, there are certain restrictions for a mourner. And this is 10 months after the loss. In fact, when the food was served at the bar mitzvah, I wasn't able to eat my plate together with everybody in the room. I actually had to take it and leave the room and eat it on my own. Because that celebratory atmosphere, which is, as we know, very much specifically around the food, that would be where it's most expressed. It wasn't about being there and being there for my family members, but that part or that segment of the celebration, I actually took my plate out and ate it somewhere else in a different room. And certain restrictions, most of all, almost all of them actually will be removed after 12 months. But again, I don't want to get into this a lot because we're going to be dealing with it next week. The point I want to make here is this. We asked, coming back to our question from the beginning of our lesson tonight, do we have a connection to the soul after the soul leaves the body? The answer, once again, is absolutely yes. And not only do we have a connection, but our phases of mourning actually directly reflect and mirror exactly what the soul is experiencing. and our mourning and the diminishing of our mourning happens and is very much aligned with the soul. We don't only relate to the soul, we don't only continue to have a relationship, we actually empathize in a very deep and profound way. We empathize with the soul and we lessen our mourning practices as the soul lessens and, well, really increases its detachment from the body and continues on its journey on high. Could I take one or two questions, please? Yes, Lou.
During this lengthened period of mourning from 3 days to 7 to 30 to 12 months, does the connection with the soul diminish over that time in any way, or does it stay constant, or does it increase?
It, as we noted earlier from the first letter from Rabbi Schneur Zalman, it has the ability and the potential to even increase. And it all depends on us. The soul is more accessible now than it was before. It's only a question of to what degree am I going to connect with the soul on its terms and learn to speak its language that it speaks now more than it did while it was in a body. So it's totally in my hands. If I find ways to express my love for my loved one now, and as much as I do it, the greater and more intense the relationship will be even today. There's no reason for the relationship to diminish whatsoever. It's in our hands. One more question? Okay, we'll proceed. We're kind of going to advance here. Until now, we were talking about the soul. We're going to spend basically the remainder of tonight's lesson going from the soul over to the body. Now, it's common for people to think that once they, the truth is here in Texas, you know, when you go to a funeral, usually they're in the cemetery already, so people are escorting the deceased to its final resting place, to the interment. But where I come from, there's a much greater degree of going first to a chapel. And very few people actually continue to the next phase over to the cemetery. I guess it has to do with temperatures, etc., which we won't get into now. But what we need to realize is this, that the way we our presence at a funeral is not just to pay respects to a friend who is experiencing a loss, etc. We have to realize that there's a lot more going on, and that the person, the deceased, is very much aware of what's going on at his or her funeral. And for that, and therefore, there's a lot of Jewish custom and tradition related to how we treat the body from the moment of passing until its final rest. And we'll learn a lot about how Judaism tells us to care for the body at that point. But first, what's the backdrop of this? How do we come to this this conclusion? What is the idea behind our attitude towards the body? So let's go ahead and read text 8a. I'll actually read it. It's from the Talmud on page 55. Text 8a, one who is present at the time of a person's passing is required to tear their clothing. This is because a person's passing is likened to the burning of a Torah scroll. A person's passing is likened to the burning of a Torah scroll. I'll read 8b. Nachmanides points to the sacred names of God that are inked onto a Torah scroll's parchment as an analogy for the sacred soul that is installed within the corporeal body. So the whole idea of how of the attitude that Judaism has to the body, even after the person passes away, comes from these teachings right here. What is a body compared to? A body is like the parchment that a Torah is written on. Now, what is a parchment? A parchment is just skins from an animal that could have become a pair of shoes or a belt also. But when you turn it into a parchment and you actually write a Torah on this parchment, the parchment becomes holy. But the parchment takes on the identity of the words that are written on it, namely God's name. When God's names in the Torah is written on this parchment becomes holy, becomes sacred. And if God forbid someone, enemies of the Jews come into a synagogue and say, burn the Torah scrolls, anyone that witnessed that event has to tear their garments, just like one does when after someone passes away. And just parenthetically, we did state here that anyone present at a passing should tear their clothing. The reality is that the sages moved that custom away from anybody and moved it over to family members only, because people were starting to avoid being present when someone would pass away, because back in the day, people didn't have many changes of clothing. And if they had to tear their clothing whenever they encountered this, they would be left with no clothing. So it became the practice that only family members do so. But again, we'll discuss this more next week. Coming back to the point that we're trying to make, the parchment takes on the identity of the very words that are written on it, and the passing of a soul from the body is likened to God forbid, the burning of a Torah scroll. And this gives us really our attitude to the body of a person who passes away. That the body, being that this body served as a container for the soul for an extended period of time, for as long as this individual lived, the body, like the parchment of a Torah, becomes sacred as well, because it housed a soul within it for such a long time. And therefore, we treat the body with incredible respect, with dignity, with sensitivity. And I'm just going to review a few things here. If you can join me on page 59 in figure 2.3, I'm just going to read through some of the traditions related to how we treat the body. Number one, the body is handled with extreme respect and dignity. Now, we know that there's a custom in Judaism, which is important for people to know about, that the body is washed before it is taken to its final rest. And I'm mentioning this and emphasizing it because many people don't even know about it. I've encountered very fine Jewish people here in our community that never heard of it before. So it's really important that we learn about these things and that we know them. During this process of when the body is being washed, and by the way, this is done by a select group of people that every Jewish community has. They're called the Chevra Kadisha. They're called the Holy Sacred Society that exists within every Jewish community, and they're responsible for this whenever it's needed in the community. But even during this process, point number two, the deceased is covered at all times. Third thing, the body is gently cleansed and dressed in shrouds. Number four, the body is never placed face down as a sign of respect. And then lighthearted conversation is avoided in the presence of the deceased. That means even in the presence of the body, while it's being prepared, the people that are there don't engage in lighthearted conversation. There's a heightened sense of sanctity in the atmosphere and how they go about the sacred duty that they're carrying out. And finally, a guard remains in proximity at all times out of respect for the deceased. The body is never left alone. From the moment of passing until its final rest, it is never left alone without a guard. These are all key and fundamental Jewish customs that are practiced at these pivotal moments, and how we show tremendous respect for the body as a result of it being it serving as a container to the soul, and the soul carrying out its mission here on earth. So once again, this extends our point and strengthens it even more. Our connection, we keep asking, what is the essence, or how do we define the connection and relationship to our loved one after its passing? It extends even to the body. We gave an analogy in last class of someone who puts on a glove. We said that the body and soul is like a hand inside a glove. And when you take the glove off of the hand and you put it down on the table, then that's like a body without a soul. and it can't move anymore. The glove has no life without my hand being in it. But we should never think that, like when we take off a glove and just put it on the table, and the glove has nothing to offer and has nothing left in it, because its life and anything it had only came from my hand. When it comes to a body, it's absolutely not that way. We never just view the body as the moment the person passes away. Okay, it serves no purpose anymore. God forbid to even suggest that. But on the contrary, we treat it with utmost respect, as we just noted in all these practices. Yes, Sid.
I just wanted to mention and expand momentarily on the Hever Kadisha.
Very brief, there, please.
Right. Just simply, there's a male Hever Kadisha and a female Hever Kadisha. The men do men, the women do women. And that's all I wanted to expound upon.
Yes, excellent point. Thank you for pointing that out. And people should definitely know that. So what we just said leads us to a very, very important and highly revered Jewish tradition. And that is what we know as burial. And we have sources in the Torah all the way back to the very Bible itself of burial being the way Judaism tells us to take care of and care for the body of a deceased. And we could take a look at text number 12. We actually have a very verse in Deuteronomy which says that you shall surely bury him on the same day. We're not getting into the topic discussed there. The point is that burial is really a mitzvah. The Torah commands us to bury a body after it passes away. And the Torah, of course, tells us about so many instances of burial, starting from Abraham and Sarah and so on and so forth. So many stories in the Torah that tell us that burial was the way the Torah told us how to take care of a body. Now, why is it? Where does it come from? Number one, why is it important? Why should I make it a priority to follow what the Torah tells us to do with a body after one passes away? So what we have to realize is this: the body is not ours. My body is not mine. I don't own it. It is given to us by God as a deposit. God puts us here in the world with a mission and gives us a body on loan, so to speak, to carry out our mission. When the time of our mission comes to an end, the body is not ours to do with it as we please. We have to return it to God exactly the way God told us we should do so. And as we know, the body comes from dust, as we noted in last class, and the body returns to dust by being placed in the ground, as we just noticed. And it is essential, and like I said, in many places in the Torah and in Jewish literature, this idea is expounded upon and made clear that the reason for that is because we have the body on loan and we give it back to God exactly the way he expects it to be returned. And being that it came from dust, we give it back the same way that it came. It came from dust and needs to return to dust. Unfortunately, and I'm just going to take a couple minutes to talk about something really critical, and that is that this tradition that Judaism places, and a sacred tradition of burial within Judaism, is seriously threatened in recent years. And that's because cremation has become really popular in the United States of America. So in 1960, they say that 3.5% of the population selected cremation. In 2020, it is 2018, it's already above 50%, 53% in 2018. Those that study these subjects suggest that in another 10 or 15 years, it will be significantly increased from where it is now. Now, I'm not here, God forbid, to judge anybody for any decisions that were made in families God forbid, I'm not condemning anyone. In fact, like I said before, many people simply aren't aware of what Judaism says and what Judaism teaches. And I, as the presenter of this course and of this class, I have to fulfill my duty and make sure that you're informed. People need to know. We need to know. We need to discuss it with people if and when it's appropriate to do so. But we have to realize this. The reality is that here in the United States, Jewish people are becoming influenced by our host culture. And again, they may not even know that Judaism says anything different. So it's essential for us to know that Judaism says that burial is the thing that needs to be done with a body after the soul departs from the body. And there's a couple of key reasons for it. Number one, as I noted before, our bodies belong to God. They're not ours to do what we like to do with them. They belong to God. And we, by burying the body, what we're doing is we're affirming our belief in this idea. We're not just saying that God gave me my body. By returning the body to God in the way God told us to, we're actually affirming this belief. And we believe that God is the owner, and we are affirming this by doing exactly what God would expect us to do with the body at this moment. That's number one. Number two, there is a fundamental belief in Judaism, and it is right up there with Maimonides in his list of 13 fundamental beliefs of Judaism, fundamental principles of faith in Judaism. And one of them is that a day will come after our righteous Redeemer and our righteous Mashiach comes. And by the way, our spring JLI course is about Mashiach and the future redemption, but we'll discuss that another time. One of the primary beliefs of what's going to happen then is what we call the resurrection of the dead, Tchiyat HaMesim. Now, resurrection of the dead obviously means that the body is going to be needed once again at that time. So when we do what God told us to do with the body by burying it and not destroying the body, when we destroy the body, what we're saying is essentially that we are denying a belief in a future need of the body. By burying the body, what we're saying is that we are again affirming our faith that the body will be needed once again in the future after Mashiach comes. So belief in the resurrection of the dead is synonymous with the belief in the enduring value of the body. And by taking the body and, God forbid, destroying it, what we're saying is that it has no sanctity, it has no purpose, and it has no meaning once the soul left it, which is obviously the opposite is true. And Judaism believes that it has a lot of meaning, and that meaning takes us all the way until the moment of the resurrection after the coming of Mashiach. So doing anything different is essentially rejecting these ideas and these fundamental beliefs of Judaism. So that's why it's really important to note these ideas. Now, just so you know, there are some claims out there that say that that it's more eco-friendly to cremate as opposed to bury. We have to realize that on the contrary, there are many arguments that cremation actually releases a great deal of carcinogenic material into the atmosphere, a lot more than burial. And there's a green burial movement out there. What we need to realize is that Judaism has been doing that from day one. Judaism doesn't add any fluids, any embalming oils. It's very simple. And so everything, the truth is that even modern day beliefs are all aligned and support what Judaism has been doing for 4,000 years now, and something that we should all take into very serious consideration, both for ourselves and for our loved ones. And just one more thing on this idea. You know, I encounter people almost on a regular basis, and very often they'll tell me that their loved one, their parent, may have included in their will their wishes to be cremated. We have to realize how profound Judaism is so against this practice, that Judaism is the number one source that teaches us that we always have to fulfill the wishes of a deceased person. If someone said, asked for a certain thing to be done, it is a tremendous mitzvah to carry out their will even after they pass away. And there is an exception. The same Torah also tells us that if somebody expressed a wish to be cremated, then the loved ones have a sacred responsibility to not fulfill their wishes in this instance. That's how far the Torah goes, by emphasizing how essential this is to Jewish belief. And the reason for that is because Torah will tell you that where the soul is now on high in heaven, the soul knows the absolute truth that cremation is certainly not in line with its wishes. It may have desired so while it was here, perhaps it never got a Jewish education, perhaps that person wasn't aware. And I'm almost certain, in almost 100% of cases, the people are not aware of what Judaism's belief is on these ideas, and therefore they express their wishes as such. But we need to realize that Torah actually tells us that in this one instance, we break from the sacred tradition of fulfilling everything a deceased person asked for. And in this case, we actually don't. So we are going to spend the final few minutes of, final 15 minutes of our lesson today, talking about a couple of additional ideas. Number one is a really important one in Jewish tradition, and that is grave visitation. We all know that visiting the grave of a loved one is right up there and has been part of Jewish tradition from day one. In fact, in the Torah itself, we find that Caleb, if you know the story of the 12 spies that Moses sent to scout out the land of Israel, so you also know that 10 of them came back with a bad report. Only two remained true to their mission. One of the two was Caleb. The other was Joshua. And about Caleb, it says, how did he stay true and not get caught up with the scheme of the other 10? And the answer is that he took a detour and traveled to Hebron and visited the resting places of our patriarchs and matriarchs, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebecca, etc. And that's where he got his assistance from, an added blessing. And ever since then, it is a sacred tradition to visit the resting place of those who have passed on. So number one, visiting the grave expresses respect for the departed. It shows that their memory has not been forgotten. They are part of our life, just on a very simple level. By visiting the resting place, it reinforces our continued connection to our loved one. You also need to remember what we discussed in the beginning of this class. We said that the lowest level of the soul, the level called nefesh, actually remains with the body. Now, it doesn't continue to animate the body, of course, but it hovers with the body. It doesn't ascend on high with the other levels of the soul. The lowest level of the soul that animated the biological function of the body remains with the body at the grave. And therefore, when you're visiting a grave, you're not just visiting a place where the body was placed, but now there may be nothing left there. Absolutely not. You're visiting the place where a dimension of that person's soul is actually present in the here and now. And that's indefinitely. That doesn't change. Many years can pass, and when you visit the gravesite, you're still encountering the soul of the person who passed away. And it actually brings comfort to the person, to the deceased. If we take a look, Sid, how about you read text 16 for us on page 66? This is also from the Zohar. It goes back to the second century.
The nefesh remains present in the grave. Due to the fact that it remains among the living, it is acquainted with their pain. At their time of need, it pleads with God for mercy on their behalf. When the inhabitants of the world are in need, when they are in sorrow and visit the cemetery, the nefesh is aroused to their plight. It ascends and awakens the ruach, which in turn entreats God for mercy. Consequently, the Holy One, blessed be He, has mercy on the world.
Thank you. What we're learning here is that the tradition of visiting a gravesite is not, of course, in Judaism, we don't pray to anyone else other than God. But when we visit a gravesite, what we're doing is we're asking the soul of our loved one to intercede on our behalf. We're asking the soul to take our prayers, whatever's on our heart, whatever we're coming to ask for and to plead for and to pray for, we ask that soul to take our prayers to God on high. So our prayers are going to God with the help of our loved one. And that tells us, and that teaches us how essential and how critical the very place of the burial place of our loved one is, that we're not only visiting the place where the body was interred, but also the very soul. And in text 17, we actually have an instance where it's expressed that the soul actually appreciates when family members or others come to visit the gravesite and actually expressed concern about people moving out of the community. It tells us about a dream someone had, who people who had passed on came to them in a dream and asked them not to leave and not to move to a different city, because then they won't have the ability to visit the cemetery. Obviously, these souls found pleasure when they were visited by their loved ones. And that's why we make an effort to bury loved ones within a proximity that will be able to pay a visit, however frequent is possible. Obviously, we have airplanes today. It's not so difficult. But nonetheless, it's clear that that the souls take pleasure in our visits to the gravesite, all underscoring and emphasizing again and again our continued relationship that we have with the souls of those who passed on. And in Judaism, it's actually recommended that we do so, obviously, whenever possible, but especially on the yard site of a loved one, also in the weeks or days before Rosh Hashanah or between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We have a custom to visit a gravesite of the righteous. Of course, being that in that season, we're turning to God and asking for blessings for the new year, we ask our loved ones to, again, intercede in our behalf. So just to summarize our lesson today, we explained, number one, how the soul's disengagement from the body allows us to have an even deeper and more essential relationship with our loved ones. That was the first point we made today in the first section. We can have an even deeper relationship than we were able to have during their lifetime. We also explained how we here in this world, we accompany the soul on its journey as the soul is detaching from the body and moving more and more into its new spiritual reality. Our mourning practices reflect that same reality. In essence, what we're doing is showing empathy to the soul as it is experiencing its painful detachment from the body. We then explain that the special relationship that we have with the deceased, it extends not just to the soul, but also to the body. And therefore, we have a great measure of care and respect for the body until it reaches its final rest. And finally, we continued on this theme and explained how our relationship with the deceased leads us to visit their resting place from time to time. I would like to conclude with another portion of a letter written by the Lubavitcher Rebbe. If I can ask Lou, would you like to read text number 18, please, on page 68? And with this, we will conclude today's lesson.
Blessings and greeting. I received your undated letter.
Sorry to cut you off. I just want to say before you start, it was written, number one, in 1958, and it was written to a woman by the name of Chana Sharfstein. She was a young woman who within a five-year period, she lost her father, her mother, and mother-in-law. And she wrote an emotional letter to the Rebbe describing how she was very much alone. And this was the response the Rebbe sent this young woman. Sorry, go ahead.
Blessing and greeting. I received your undated letters in which you write about your emotional upsets in connection with the passing of your mother and the questions which are troubling you in this connection, involving also questions in regard to the passing of your father, peace unto them. Another fundamental point to remember, which has a direct bearing on your letter, is that all believers in God believe also in the survival of the soul. Actually, this principle has even been discovered in this physical world, where science now holds as an absolute truth that nothing in the physical world can be absolutely destroyed. How much more so in the spiritual world, especially in the case of the soul, which in no way can be affected by the death and disintegration of the physical body. It would be silly and illogical to assume that because a certain organ of the body ceases to function, affecting other physical organs of the body, the spiritual soul would also be affected thereby. The truth is that when the physical body ceases to function, the soul continues its existence not only as before, but even on a higher level, in as much as it is no longer handicapped by the restraints of the physical frame. Thirdly, the attachment of children to their parents and the general attachment between close relatives during life on this earth is surely not a physical attachment by the respective physical bodies of the relatives. Essentially, the attachment is a spiritual one, due to the spiritual affinity between those concerned and the qualities of the soul, including such spiritual things as character, kindness, goodness, etc., all of which are attributes of the soul and not of the body. Therefore, also every action on the part of a person in relation to a beloved person and the desire to benefit that person is not directed toward pleasing his physical body, his bones and tissue, for it is the spiritual pleasure that one is connected with. In view of the above, it is clear that even after the physical body has disintegrated and disappeared from view, it is still possible to bring joy and benefit to the soul, which, as noted above, not only survives, but does so on a higher level. And all the things which had previously brought joy and pleasure to one's parents will continue to do so even after they are physically no longer here.
Thank you very much, Lou. So that tells us that we should definitely think of ways of how to express our love for that individual and find ways to strengthen the bond, which, as we said before, can be even deeper and more profound than it was during their lifetime. And the way to do so, of course, is to consider the terms on which we need to relate to our loved ones during this present reality, where they are now in a more spiritual reality. Thank you so much for joining lesson number 2.